Lecture 2, The Aesthetics of Harmony.
I've titled this second lecture, The Aesthetics of Harmony, and what I want to capture in that is the ancient Greek sense of the relationship between the beautiful and the harmonic, where harmonia refers not so much to music, though it can include that. The ancient Greek word for that would be more usually rendered as melodia than harmonia, but harmonia in the sense of aptness or fitness, as hand in glove. Again, things being right, getting it right, a kind of Pythagorean abstract numerological fitness, the equation that balances. To this day, mathematicians talk about an equation or a mathematical proof being elegant, that it's the right proof when it has a certain aesthetic quality. And of course, this is just, I don't want to say it's a throwback to the ancient Greek way of thinking. I want to say that the ancient Greeks recognized this feature also of the comparability, the analogy, maybe the identity between the true and the beautiful, where the beautiful is, in the aesthetic sense, the most fitting, the most apt, the most harmonious, the right sort of thing, the perfected sort of thing. Now, Aristotle begins what I think many would regard as the most subtle and sophisticated ancient treatise in philosophy, maybe even more so than Plato's Timaeus. Aristotle begins the metaphysics in a most disarming way. Here's this metaphysical treatise. Metaphysics, we'll find out from Aristotle in one of the later books, is finally understood a kind of theology. I mean, this is the study, the science of first things, the science of actual being, what has real existence, ontology and so forth. How does he begin it? He begins it this way. This is a quote from Aristotle's Metaphysics, the beginning of Book One. All men by nature desire to know. An example of that is the delight we take in our senses. For apart from their usefulness, they are loved in and of themselves, and none more than the sense of sight. What Aristotle is recording here is the ancient Greek sense of the power of the seen, the power of what appeals to us at the level of direct visual perception. In the previous lecture, I mentioned Hecuba saying to Menelaus, if you're going to kill Helen, when you raise your sword, don't look at her. This awareness that what is seen molds thought, molds mind, molds character. The ancient Greek world took nothing visual for granted. They dismissed nothing that appealed directly and powerfully to the senses, because what appeals to us at that level can come to have a controlling influence on our lives. It can shape our characters. The ancient Greek is first and most a spectator. I would want to reinforce that image of the ancient Greek. The ancient Greek as spectator. And of course, one of the things he's looking at in a painstaking way is himself, so that he might know himself. Nothe se auton. Is, in one rendition, look at yourself, examine yourself, take stock of yourself, understand the kind of being and entity that you are. Now, it's only a people thus aware of the power of what is seen and heard, the power of the seen, the visual seen, the power of the word, that will develop an art and drama and architecture that will themselves retain their power over the ages. In the previous lecture, I mentioned the Renaissance recovery of the ancient humanistic orientation of the classical Greek world. Toward the end of his life, a great, great artist of the Renaissance claimed that what he had aspired to achieve in this long and productive life, he finally failed to achieve. He said, what I was after all along and never got, that one thing necessary, is the symmetria prisca of the ancient Greek world, the pure symmetry of the ancient Greek world. And who said that? Leonardo da Vinci said that. He thought he had missed it. And I think I pointed out in an earlier lecture series for the teaching company, and I say this as one of the legion of admirers of Leonardo da Vinci, of course, that in fact, to a very considerable extent, he did miss it. The entire Renaissance missed it. And the entire Renaissance missed it in just the way that ancient Rome missed it. There's no confusing the statues of Hellenic Greece and Imperial Rome. It's not just a difference in the marble and the like. It's a difference. It's not just a difference in the articulation. It is true that the Roman, as will be the case with the Renaissance sculpture, is overly articulated. It's a bit too muscular and the like. But what I would point out is the thematic differences. You don't see the Romans spending too much time, unless they're doing a pastiche, you don't see the Roman sculptor spending time on a young boy taking a thorn or pebble out of his foot, or a maiden just carrying flowers. This utterly human, we are human, we know we are not gods, we resist and avoid and eschew the hubristic arrogation to ourselves of anything divine. And what we get in return for that is the possibility of celebrating what is wonderfully human about us. And this calls for a certain pure symmetry. But the pure symmetry is not just a balancing in the geometric sense. It's a symmetry of thought. It's a symmetry of thought and feeling. It's the perfect fitness that exists between and among the thought object, the seen object, the felt object, and the known object. It's this utter integration of the cognitive, perceptual, affective, and moral. It's quite dazzling in its truth. Not inevitably dazzling in any other way. In fact, if it is dazzling in the other way, then it's not Hellenic at all. It's late Hellenistic. Well, succeeding ages will honor these achievements with, as I say, pastiches, and I don't want to be smug about that. Some of these so-called pastiches, some of these copies, are exquisite in their own right. In the previous lecture, I mentioned the 18th century classic revival, and indeed, 18th century architecture needs no defense from me. Some of it is just absolutely magnificent. There are entire European cities whose architecture is inspired, directly inspired, by the ancient Greek world. We don't have to pause long to look at Palladian windows, at Fischer von Erlach's design of Vienna and the like, before Washington, D.C., indeed. We're not far from there, even as I speak. Wherever you are listening or viewing these tapes, I should tell you that we are in the shadows of Washington, D.C., which is just flooded with Greco-Roman type architecture of all sorts, and of course the inevitable obelisk, which even the ancient Greek world occasionally would look toward Egypt, generally not for models. I should say that one of the debts the ancient Greek world does have to the earlier Egyptian civilization is the idea of architecture as indeed rhetorical, the monumental function of architecture. Architecture as a way of preserving memories, making statements, recording principles, values, and the like. But what the Greek world does with it is humanize it, whereas in the earlier Egyptian civilization, the monumental architecture is recording chiefly the works and doings of the pharaohs, the living gods, and the like. There's an inextricable connection between the religion and the architecture of the Egyptian world that we do not see, even in the temple architecture of the Greek world. It's not irreligious. Religion, as we'll see in a later lecture, has a different cast in the ancient Greek world. Now, I've referred to the difference between Hellenism and Hellenistic art and architecture. In the Hellenistic, you see the same movement away from the pure symmetry that the High Renaissance shows, the High Renaissance becoming the Baroque in relation to the Italian Renaissance of Quattrocento Florence. There's just too much of a good thing, do you see? And with the Hellenistic developments, again, there's rather too much of a good thing. Anyway, what's this Hellenism all about and Hellenistic all about? Well, the mythos here, which we get from Hesiod, the mythos goes something like this. You do know about that chap Prometheus, that Titan, who took a particular fondness for human beings and the human condition did the best he could to bail us out. Zeus had long since decided that we weren't worth the effort. He was just going to do us in, stripped us even of the means by which to make an evening fire. And Prometheus, forethought, thinking ahead, Prometheus gets a spark, gets it on the tip of fennel, and brings it down to us, so we've got fire. Do you see? Zeus doesn't like this one bit, so you know Prometheus's sad fate, where he's sort of tied up and there's an eagle pecking away at his liver all the time. Now, Zeus decides to do us in how? With a flood, of course. He's just going to rain us out of existence, do you see? Prometheus again comes and tells Deucalion that there's a flood coming, and you better make what? You better make an ark. So Deucalion and his wife, Pyrrha, they put this ship together, and it gets beached on Mount Parnassus, and an oracle tells them to throw bones over their shoulders. They start picking up stones, throwing them over their shoulders, and what Deucalion throws over his shoulder becomes men, and what Pyrrha throws over her shoulder becomes women. We've got the whole thing started, do you see? And Deucalion and Pyrrha have their own offspring, of whom surely the most heroic and wondrous is Helene. And the Attic people thought that their origins dated back to that offspring of Deucalion and Pyrrha. This is sort of an Adam and Eve story. I think just about every culture has these things. So the Hellenes already recognize themselves as having a unique origin, something distinguishable from barbarian peoples, different from barbarian peoples, and this will always be in place in the ancient Greek world, the sense that where Greek is not the language, where Greek culture is not the culture, where the Greek sense of paideia is not the animating principle of daily life, that's a place not to stay long, do you see? Do a little business and then get back on your ships and return. Nastos, come back. Now, how sudden was this Hellenic achievement? Did it all come from the brow of Zeus? Did it just pop out the way Athena herself did? Well, this is a vexed question, isn't it? If you take a look at Minoan and Mycenaean art and architecture, you don't see anything there that's going to be redolent. It doesn't really anticipate what we take to be the flowering of Hellenic art and architecture. There are certain anticipations, but I think the clearest picture here, at least something that I've always found quite striking, can be found at the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford, which has an extraordinary collection of pottery. And it goes back to 3000 BC and then ahead. And from 3000 BC to 2000 BC, not much seems to be happening. I'm talking about clay pots now, amphoras and calyxes and the like. And from 2000 BC to 1000 BC, not very much seems to be happening. Now you start getting geometric patterns and that sort of thing. And from 1000 BC to 600 BC, not very much seems to be happening. And all of a sudden, in the late 6th century and 5th century, you begin to get these wondrously beautiful, perfected, utterly humanistic designs. So it is happening fairly quickly. And indeed, in the age of Pericles, it happens with even greater acceleration. Because you now get the entire resources of the municipality, of the polis. You see, you now get a political leadership and a population, grudging or not, putting their shoulder to the wheel and putting in place massive, artistic, creative productions that will signal the uniqueness of the Athenian world. It really is, it's a long time gestating, but at birth it doesn't look very much like any of its earlier fetal or embryonic forms, if I may use that analogy. And of course, what's common throughout is proportion, harmony, fitness, balance, this Pythagorean sense that you get it right when the numbers are right, when there's an equation that covers it. Now, what's behind that? What's behind that is the understanding that what is universal is universally true. And what is universally true is What instantiations do we have of the universally true? Only one, mathematics. So it is in the undying truth of the mathematical formula, the Pythagorean theorem, later on, 3rd century Euclid. But this sense that the ancient Greek mathematicians are already working out something of philosophical and aesthetic importance. It's not just mathematics. In fact, the term just is a term we want to eliminate from the vocabulary of the movers and shakers of the ancient Greek world. Nothing is just something. It's all important. It all has to be taken into account. This is what perfectionism is all about. The Pythagorean theorem is not true of an awful lot of right-angle triangles. It's true of every right-angle triangle. It's the very definition of the right-angle triangle. What fails of that equation fails to be that sort of entity. And this is going to animate the sculptors, the architects, the dramatists, and, of course, famously, Plato and his friends in the Academy. Meson Ariston, the proportion, the mean, the golden mean is best. Nothing to excess. And what is more characteristic of the Hellenic achievement in sculpture and in architecture than the lack of excess? What is most characteristic of it is restraint. Nothing is overdone. There isn't anything gaudy. There are no pink flamingos on the Acropolis, you see. I shan't mention MacDonald arches either, unless you make me mention those. The Greek victory over Persia was the most momentous event in the ancient Greek world. And it was very much part of the consciousness of the ancient Greek that this battle with Persia, that what Persia tried to do to tyrannize Greeks, to reduce them to slavery, to reduce them to the state of being that Persians themselves had, not as citizens, but as slaves, that should never be forgotten. And so, in fact, there were laws written that what the Persians had burned should stay in place and never be changed. It should always be there as a monument of what almost happened to the Hellenes, do you see? And Pericles changed all that. And this is a momentous event in the history of Western civilization. It isn't so much let bygones be bygones. It is let us not be trapped in the memories of our own difficulties, because these are not universal. Let's try to put in place something that is forward-looking, that will always be right and always true, and will represent what we stand for, not simply what we endured, but what we are all about. And that's what the Acropolis was all about. These are buildings built on what already were shrines, wooden buildings, previously burned buildings, that had to be torn down or built over with a new and expensive marble. It cost the polis a fortune to put this thing up. And there were many, many arguments against it. And Pericles sat with his friends, with the redoubtable Aspasia, and she was quite a piece of work in her own right, and with famous Phidias, who did much to supervise the construction of the buildings on the Acropolis and the Parthenon, which is probably the best example of harmony in all of ancient Greek sculpture, the Parthenon itself. This is the temple of the maiden, Athena Parthenos, do you say. Phidias supervises all this. Ictinus and Callicrates are the architects directly involved with it. And there the Athenian citizens are standing back and seeing how much money is being spent on this, and indeed Phidias himself is going to be charged with extortion, with robbing some of the gold that he used. He'll serve a little time in jail. Pericles, later on, when asking the Athenians to allow his own son by Aspasia to have Greek citizenship, will be turned down. He faces ostracism, a period of 10 years of exile, because the Athenians have convinced themselves that the walls he put up to protect the city are the source of the plague. So I want you to understand that the political tensions within that world were not only every bit as great as our own, but much greater than our own. Factionalism. Litigation, constant litigation, turning on one's heroes, not wanting to spend the money, thinking the whole thing is a kind of abuse of power. What's all this stuff about beauty anyway? Do you see? All that's going on, and yet, at the end of the day, it's not only done, but it is done. There's nothing compromising in that art and architecture. Factionalism will result in one side winning and one side losing, but what we're not going to get are buildings by committee. We won't do it at all unless we can do it right. And when we do it right, we'll know it's right, because the numbers will match. It's the aesthetics of harmony. It's the mathematics of beauty. It is only beautiful, truly, if its beauty is undying. And the only beauty that is undying is the beauty captured abstractly. Now, this, of course, was not going to last forever. I should say that between the time Pericles had all this done and when cows could be found grazing on the Acropolis, it's just a couple of hundred years. The good news is that human nature is capable of great and lasting beauty in its creations, and the bad news is that we're also capable of unbelievable vulgarity, short-sightedness, and faction. Now, what happens with the movement of Hellenism to the Hellenistic age? What's Alexander the Great up to here? He's going to Hellenize the world. Now, how do you Hellenize the world? That is, he's conquered just about everything that moves. Can you imagine being in the infantry of Alexander the Great when he first confronts the forces of India? And, for the first time in your life, seeing not just an infantry approaching you, but an armed force on the backs of elephants, creatures you've only heard about, bearing down on you, this sort of elephantine juggernaut. And he won these battles. He won almost all of, he won all the battles. He commanded 10,000 of his troops to marry Persian women as a way of accelerating the Hellenization of the East. Do you see, this is a fellow who had an agenda. There's no question about it. He wasn't just kidding around. By the time he has been in the East for a period, we find him donning the robes of the Eastern potentate and wearing peculiar headdress. He's becoming Easternized even as he seeks to Hellenize those conquered in the East. He's not finally a Hellene himself, do you see? He's given to these, what might be called these Asiatic excesses. And I don't mean that as an ethnic slur. I mean it as a cultural description. There's a certain excessiveness, a certain lack of restraint, a certain repetitiveness, but a repetitiveness that reaches the level of a kind of self-conscious ornamentation in dress, in statuary. Ultimately what? Well, on the Greek view, then, ultimately in all things. Because you can't partition life into the aesthetic, the moral, the civic, the scientific, the philosophical, the mathematical, the familial, the legal. No, no, no. They fit together or they don't. You cannot have an ugly and vulgar architecture and a refined population. You cannot have buildings, statuary, and literature that celebrates the most mean and distorted and depraved, and have a citizenry nonetheless able to rise to the level of the heroic. Who were the people who looked up at these perfected statues put together by Phidias and Myron and the others? Do you honestly think, does anybody honestly think that they looked anything like Achilles or Odysseus? That they looked anything like Helen or Penelope or Andromache or Hector? These are people who had not a particularly good diet. Olives grow profusely in Greece, and lemons do fairly well. This is a place that had to start importing food as early as the late 7th and early 6th centuries BC. It's why they're colonizing places like Asia Minor and Sicily and the like to grow food and send it back. It's a rocky, tough terrain. Hippocrates notwithstanding, medical science had not reached anything like modern achievements. We have a pockmarked and very often impoverished population, given to superstitious excess, given to religious frenzies, given to the ordinary vices to which the human flesh is heir, and having bodies and spirits comparably distorted, looking up at this statuary, at these friezes and fillerets, sitting in the Greek theater and watching these productions, and discovering what? Discovering human potentialities, almost never to be fully realized, but unless the perfected version is constantly held before one, one will give in to what is most petty in oneself, most vulgar and depraved. The art and architecture pull off something that I think is almost unmatched, in my experience anyway, it's unmatched in the history of art and architecture. And that is artistic works that are at once rhetorical and never propagandistic. And I think one of the reasons for that is that almost none of the art and architecture is ever purely religious or ideological in its orientation. The contact is always at the level of human life and human possibilities. Even when Athena, Hera, Zeus, and the like are being depicted, how are they being depicted? They're being depicted as gods who do many, many human sorts of things, but better. You don't get this sense of transcendence. The transcendence comes from the universality, not from anything you would try to paint or sculpt or build, do you see? Rhetorical without being propagandistic. Well, it's always time in a lecture of this sort to become something of a scold, particularly if in your earlier incarnation you died in the 4th century B.C., as I sometimes think I did. What form might the scolding take? The easiest thing in the world, of course, is to say, look at the McDonald arches or any contemporary condominium and your reaction has to be, comma, quote, you can never find a terrorist when you need one, close quote. That's too easy. The McDonald's stands are put up to sell hamburgers to large numbers of people at as low a price as you can, quite apart from the question of whether anybody ought to eat such a thing. You understand that McDonald's is doing what McDonald's is doing for McDonald's reasons. McDonald's is a private corporation. What you look to are our civic endeavors. What the government does in our name, the buildings that the government puts up, that our own municipalities put up, what we allow to happen in our own towns and villages, where the power lines go, how wide the highways get, where the highways run through residential neighborhoods, what a public school building looks like, what children at the age of 4 and 5 and 6 years old are taught implicitly is the nature of an architectural undertaking. And these, of course, are not obscene. They're nothing. They're absolutely nothing. They're simply boxes. And in fact, under the prevailing enthusiasms, according to which the last thing you would ever allow the polis to do is preach to us at a moral level and an aesthetic level, we make very sure that we never have anything of a civic nature go up that is rhetorical, except where the rhetoric is a kind of funky egalitarianism guaranteed to offend nobody. Now, the point I want to make one more time is this. The ancient Greek world is not only a factioned world, but the central faction, the faction that's creating the faction, is what in contemporary terms might be called the middle class. Against what? Well, what in contemporary terms might be called an aristocratic class. This is finally going to destroy that world. It's going to render it fit for defeat, first by Sparta and then by Alexander the Great himself. So there's always been that. There's always been this tension, do you see? That's not new to us. Nonetheless, the great civic undertakings of the period are celebrations of perfection, of the most we can hope to be, not our average selves, but our best selves. And the scold, therefore, is not be a Hellene or be inclined to Greek. The scold is just know thyself, and we know ourselves in virtue of what we do, and when we put up horrible buildings, and we patronize horrible and salacious literature and the like, we find out something about ourselves that's demeaning and depreciatory, as opposed to elevating and nearly divine. Thanks.